This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in June.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with Freeman Ng, author of Bridge Across the Sky, a young adult novel in verse based on the Chinese immigration experience through Angel Island in the early 1900s. He says that in his bookstore appearances and school visits with the book, he's been surprised at how unfamiliar people are with the basic story of Angel Island. He feels more duty-bound than ever to tell it, especially in these days of heightened xenophobia. He's a former Google software engineer, he's now a full-time writer, and his books include The House We Sheltered In, a pandemic picture book, Basho's Haiku Journeys, haiku picture book, Who Am I?, which is a personalized picture book, and other books include Joan, which is a novel of Joan of Arc. Freeman Ng, thanks for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Am I saying your name correctly?
Yep.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right. I did look it up on Google, so there we go. So tell me a bit about your background. Tell me about your life before you became a Google software engineer, and then we'll get to after.
Well, I spent most of my life as a software engineer, but I also spent most of my life writing on the side. I would go into work, and after work I would go out to dinner somewhere and write. Or I would write during my lunch breaks. All during my years at Google, they probably thought of me as being very antisocial because I was always turning down invitations to join people for lunch. I was always going out and just writing on my own during my lunch breaks.
I guess at a certain point you decided, well, I'm going to do that full time?
What happened was I decided to retire from work in order to take care of my mother and to make a go of writing full time. So I lived with her for the last few years of her life, and then I've been on my own writing totally full time since.
What was that like to make that leap? I guess it's kind of scary at first, right? Am I going to be able to make a go of it?
It was scary, and it still is a little scary. I'm hoping very much that Social Security stays solvent.
Right. That provides a safety net for the time being. Yeah.
But on the whole, I'm glad I made the decision. I love the fact that I can spend all my time working on things that matter to me now, as opposed to some company's agenda, some other, goal. It's quite fulfilling.
So a broad range of things, poetry, right? Several books for young people.
Books for young people, poetry, a political comic strip. I think part of the reason why I work on so many different things is that my writing career took so long to finally take off. In that time, if it had happened much earlier, I might have a particular brand. I might have a particular specialty, in terms of what I write. I would be following up some earlier book with similar books and sort of building on that. But instead, over the years, I just developed lots of different interests. I tried lots of different things, and so now that I'm a published author, I'm still motivated to try out all those different things.
You mentioned the political comic strip Trumpert. It's a parody of Dilbert.
Yeah, I started that after Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert, came out in support of Donald Trump, which was quite surprising to me and many other fans of his, because Dilbert is very much a strip ridiculing the powers that be, ridiculing the absurdity of the pointy-haired boss in the strip. And then here he came out in favor of the ultimate, the quintessential pointy-haired boss. So I felt I needed to say something about that. And I also needed some way of coping with that first Trump administration. So partway through the first Trump administration, I began writing this strip.
Mm. You have done at periods a haiku a day. Are you still doing that?
I'm currently posting a haiku a day as reruns from the earlier effort. From 2010 to 2015, I wrote one haiku a day, and I posted it to a set of social media feeds. And then in 2022, I think I resumed it for another 3 years. So there's 8 years of daily haiku in my database, sort of. Right now I'm just reposting reruns from them. I might resume the daily habit at some point in the future, but for now I'm just posting the reruns.
So let's get into the current book, Bridge Across the Sky. We can loop back to some of this other things later in the hour. So you say that you've lived most of your life within a 20-minute ferry ride of Angel Island, never visited the station. I mean, that resonates. There are things in Utah I've never done, but I've lived here, But what got you to go out there?
Well, it was learning about the poems. I knew for most of my life, growing up in the Bay Area, I knew the history of Angel Island. I knew what was happening with immigration through the station there. My own father actually entered the country through a similar process, except through Seattle. So I had family connections. I had objective awareness of the story. But I was never interested in writing about it until I heard about the poems that the detainees carved into the walls of their barracks. When I learned about the poems, I knew I had to write about it.
What was it? What is it about the poems?
Well, I think they're an example of A, the power of poetry to express people's lives, and B, the human impulse, whether through poetry or not, to express itself on the walls of its dwellings. I think of the poems on the walls of Angel Island as being connected to a long line of human endeavor stretching all the way back to the cave paintings in France, the prehistoric cave paintings in France. Humans just have this impulse to chart their lives on the walls of their dwellings. Graffiti on the streets, another example. Graffiti that you might see on the streets, right around the corner of wherever you're working or living right now.
So you say in the book Angel Island, I'll just quote you, Angel Island has been often called the Ellis Island of the West, but could not have been more different. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, that's the often the first response I get from people when I say the name Angel Island. But while Ellis Island was built in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty, which calls for the tired, the poor, the huddled masses to come to these shores, Angel Island was built primarily in order to execute the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which prohibited, which was a law that was passed after a number of violent incidents against Chinese in America, and which prohibited further immigration from China unless you were in a certain a couple of very narrow categories, one of which, the biggest of which, was that you were the direct relative of someone who was already in the States. The Exclusion Act for 2 decades basically largely dried up immigration from China until the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire, which destroyed family records and business records in the city and allowed Chinese who wanted to immigrate to the States a way to get in by pretending, claiming that they were relatives of someone who was already living in the States, and there would be no city records to that you could look up to confirm their story. So what had to happen instead was Chinese immigrants had to be detained for some period so that their stories could be checked out. And the way this would happen is they would isolate the immigrant and the resident, and they would ask them the same questions about their common life back in China when they supposedly lived together back in China. And if you got any if any of your answers didn't match, then you could be rejected. Whereas if you got all your answers right, then you could be let in. The station was built in order to house detainees during this period. While it was a reasonably good method for handling the situation where you no longer had these, you know, family records. There were some problems, one of which was that the detainees were treated very poorly while they were detained, treated as if they were criminals already in advance. And also the detentions could last for quite a while. The process was very slow, and often the detainees would have to remain in custody for months, or in some cases, even years. In one case that we know of through one of the poems written on the walls, for over a year without even having been asked a single question yet. So Angel Island was quite an ordeal for those who passed through it, as opposed to Ellis Island, where the average detention time was just a few hours.
Talk a little bit more about the Chinese Exclusion Act. This was targeted, you know, as the name implies, against the Chinese. Other types of immigrants were being welcomed. The Chinese not welcome.
Yeah, what happened was it was primarily, I think, because so many Chinese immigrated to America during the gold rush for the gold, and then stayed and continued to immigrate to the States during the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad. So there was quite a large population of Chinese on the West Coast. And the problem in the eyes of white Americans was that after the work on the Transcontinental Railroad ended, there were all these Chinese in America who wanted to stay. They wanted to keep on working. They wanted to continue sending money home, perhaps bring their families over. And fears and anger began to arise over the framing that the Chinese were stealing white jobs, which is a refrain that I think has recurred many times throughout American history, aimed at one group, then the next group, and then the next group. And in this case, it was the Chinese who were targeted. This led to several high-profile cases of violence against the Chinese, which probably peaked in 1871 when an angry white mob descended on the Los Angeles Chinatown and killed 18 Chinese men, which was about one-tenth, actually, of the total Chinese population of the Chinatown, 17 of them by hanging, which made that incident the largest mass lynching in U.S. history. So it was in response to this wave of anti-Chinese violence that the law was passed.
You say one of the things you want to accomplish here is to get this history out. You do school visits, et cetera, and you've said that a lot of people don't know this history. What's the obvious detriment to all of us if we don't know this history?
Yeah, I think it's important for us to remember our history, especially the problematic parts of it. I think that it's important, it's useful and important to know that when these tropes arise again, generation after generation, this group is stealing our jobs, this group is, you know, eating our pets, that sort of thing, to know that these claims are not new, that they come from a very old and standard playbook. It's useful to know that every group that's been discriminated against in the past has eventually come to become accepted parts of American society. This story has played out, you know, over and over and over again. There's that old saying that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And so it's very important that we not forget this past.
You've said that those in power today are actively suppressing knowledge, at least some in power are trying to suppress the knowledge of the wrongs of the past. So that goes even a step further, right? Let's actively try to have us forget this past.
Exactly. That's a sort of a corollary to the old saying that I've been using a lot these days, that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it, but those who are intentionally suppressing teaching about the wrongs of our past are trying to repeat them. I think that makes it more urgent than ever that we remember the past and that we hold it up and remind ourselves of the errors we've made in the past.
So today, of course, current government has a very, very restrictive immigration policy. How do you, and I'm sure you're in favor of less restrictive, at least, well, I guess I'll ask you that. Do you favor less restrictive immigration policy?
I definitely believe that immigration has been a good thing for this country. I definitely believe that immigrant groups in the past have come to form really valuable and essential components of American society. And I definitely believe that fear of immigration has been a tool used in the past and in the present to appeal to certain voting blocks in this country that would be best marginalized, that would be best not catered to, at least in terms of those particular desires.
So you said one of the things that's been levied over and over again is they're taking our jobs. Whatever immigrant group it is, they're taking our jobs, right?
Right.
Like there are other tropes that appear mm-hmm. over and over again. Right. I think they're not melting into the melting pot.
Right.
They're persisting in their culture too much. They're not joining us.
Right. Even the very specific and bizarre trope recently that immigrant groups in Ohio were eating their neighbors' pets. Those were the kinds of framings placed around the Chinese during the gold rush days. So really, when you hear these things, you should understand that, you know, they were not the first time that they're used. When you go back in history and you see the charges that were levied against the Chinese and other groups, you should understand that those were not the last time that those charges would be made.
Well, let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll talk about the book in specific, have you read a couple of passages. We're talking with Freeman Ng. His latest book is Bridge Across the Sky. It's a young adult novel in verse based on the Chinese immigration experience through Angel Island. We'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah today. I'm Tom Williams, and my guest is the writer Freeman Ng. He's author of the latest book, is Bridge Across the Sky. It's a young adult novel in verse based on the Chinese immigration experience through Angel Island in the early 1900s. So, Freeman Ng, I just want to read the little blurb, the little description of the plot here. So, 1924, I think. The year, Tygo arrives at Angel Island Immigration Station with his father and grandfather, where due to the dictates of Chinese Exclusion Act, which only allows certain categories of immigrants to enter the country, they're detained for 3 months while their claims are evaluated. And though Tygo didn't want to come to America in the first place, his experiences of the prison-like conditions and harsh treatment of detention, the friends he makes, the poems he discovers carved into the walls of the barracks, help him to begin imagining a life he might live in this new land. But first, he has to come to terms with his own racism and with a perceived rival who stands in the way of his happiness. So there's the kind of the plot in brief. So I wonder if you'd read a passage from, I guess, the beginning of the book.
I'd be happy to. I should say that, we'll start with, I'll go ahead and read it first and then we'll see. The book begins like this, a fallow field. I picture yesterday's river, outside the village that was once my home, beyond the grove of dove trees with their long blossoms hanging like wrinkled paper bats. The river our parents forbade us to swim, where we'd plunge into the churn, blinded by cold and the bright froth, propelling ourselves, crossways to the current, to rise, arms lifted, shivering, on the rocks of the far side. I hear our laughter rising from streets we knew as well as the outlines of our muscles, where the old men and the married women called out greetings for our families, gossiped about our doings and our futures beneath a morning moon. I feel still the labor, stooping, stooping, stooping in the fields all day. The soil drinking the strength we'd carried from our beds. But we knew we'd rise with yet more strength the next day, and every day that followed, and that, in due course, we would harvest all. A house, a job, a girl, a life. I should be there. I would be there, but for my father and the plan he nursed for who knows how long, before springing in on us, on me, the day I lost tomorrow.
Beautiful. That's from Bridge Across the Sky. Understand this is, at least this experience, based on an experience your father had.
Right. It's the opening stanza about my protagonist swimming through the river, rapid, is based on the only story I ever heard my father tell about his youth. He never spoke to us children about his life before us. And I only overheard him telling this story to some friends one day, how as a young man he used to swim in this river rapid, and how, you know, the white foam used to blind him, and how he used to press his way through the water. And so when it came time to write this book and to say something about the past life of my protagonist that he wishes he had not been forced to leave, I naturally thought of that story of my father's.
It's interesting how, you know, we tend to know a lot about our parents, obviously, but there are parts that we don't know a lot of times. You said you'd known him as a hardworking, cautious man of simple domestic pleasures. This is a story, and he didn't tell this to you. He told it to somebody else, right, the story?
Yeah. I could not imagine him as a young man doing what he did. And in fact, I learned after his death, when I was talking to uncles and other family members and kind of researching his biography, that the reason why he came to America in the first place was that his father was already living in San Francisco, and his father had gotten very concerned about the wild life that my father was living in China, and he basically sent for him to come over to the States so he could sort of try to get his head straight. It was unbelievable to me. I would never have guessed that was my father's past.
Hmm. So your father was an herbalist. Tell me about that. And that appears in the book, a contrast of Eastern medicine with Western medicine.
Yep, that was the other aspect of my father's life that I was able to mine for the use in the book. My father was an herbalist. He basically boiled various combinations of herbs in order to create these very bitter smelling, bitter tasting teas that he would give to his patients. His method of diagnosis, I'll never forget. He would diagnose your condition entirely by taking your pulse, or taking your pulses. I guess he would place three fingers on various spots on your wrist. And that's one of my memories from growing up, is just the feeling, my hand resting on this soft little pad with his fingers on my wrist, reading my pulses, basically diagnosing my illnesses. My other childhood memory, of course, is being forced to drink those horribly bitter teas. But that was a memory that I was able to use in the book as well. Because one of the problematic aspects of writing this story was that some of the hardships that the Chinese detainees underwent were deliberately aimed at them. They were deliberate hardships. The conditions of their imprisonment, their treatment there, the trickiness of the interrogation process, these were all difficulties that were intentional. But there were some difficulties they experienced that were unintentional, that were purely because of the cultural differences. And one of the things was the medical examinations. When they first entered the country, they had to undergo medical examinations, which involved blood draws and having to provide urine samples, you know, samples of their poop, basically. Mm-hmm. And they had to be examined, you know, half pretty much undressed. And all these things were things that they were very unused to and were quite traumatizing. A pretty good percentage of the poems on the walls are about that experience. But they weren't intentional experiences. They were accidentally traumatizing. And so I struggled with how to portray this in the novel, and finally decided that a good way to do it would be to write one poem that contrasted those Western medical practices with the medical practices that my protagonist was used to back in China. And for that, I used my father as the model, that the gentleness of his touch on my wrist as he, you know, diagnosed my illnesses.
I want to read just a short passage from the book. This is Taigo remembering back. He says, "I think of the man that everyone in the village, elder to child, calls Doc. My wrist on the worn cloth pad he sets on the wooden table between us. The pad that smells, I smelled it once when he was out of the room, holding its softness up to my face, like the skin and sweat of everyone else in my village." That really struck me, that sense of community, that he gets this through the smelling this pad that everybody's put their wrist on, right?
Right.
And an immigrant like that is losing that community. There's usually something, a big pull or a push, right? And in today's world, it's war or, you know, economic upheaval or whatever, that would push someone from a community where they do feel safe.
Exactly. That was an additional trauma for many of these immigrants. Many of them were poor farmers who came from small villages. And suddenly they're separated from their villages, they're separated from their culture. They're tossed into detention with fellow Chinese, yes, but Chinese from many different areas, many different states of life. It was quite disorienting.
There's a passage in the book where Taigo and his father and grandfather have to recite their stories, right? And this functionary never looks up. He's writing, and Tygo's embarrassed that the father's telling too much. He's too chatty.
Right.
but Taigo, there's a passage book where he says, "Here's my story." And you get to the end of that, and he says, "None of that is true." Because this is his paper story, right? Tell me about that.
Exactly. This was the mechanism that many Chinese used to get into the country after the 1906 San Francisco fire and earthquake destroyed all those family records, is that they could claim to be the direct relative of someone who was already living in the States. And what they would often do is Chinese living in the States who had would agree to pretend to be the resident relative. And then they would have to get their story straight. They would have to, anticipate the questions they would be asked, and come up with answers that matched. So Taigo enters the country with a very elaborate story about where he was born, where he lived, who his relatives were, all that stuff, who his brother was, and that sort of thing. And he basically, throughout the entire novel, goes by that paper name. He reveals his true name only once in the novel, at the very end, at the climax of the novel. But throughout the rest of the novel, he's maintaining this disguise. It was really quite fascinating. There's a lot about these paper stories that I wasn't able to fit entirely into the novel, but they were quite fascinating. There was a whole network designed to learn what the questions were probably going to be, to ascertain what the answers would be, and to smuggle in the answers to detainees who were currently in the station. There was a whole black market of identities that you could purchase, people... Chinese residents of the States who had available slots, as it were, who had actual children who were not, who were never planning to come to the States, or perhaps had, you know, who perhaps had died or whatever, could sell those slots and make them available to others who wanted to come to the country. It was a whole big setup, and I put a little bit of this into the novel, but not as much as I could have. It was quite a complicated system.
Now, you include in the novel some of the actual poems from The Walls, right, of Angel Island?
I do, yeah, yeah. I do.
There's one at the very beginning of the book. I wonder, could you read that for us? That choose that, because it's easy, be easy to find. So you do yeah. quote some actual, you know, poems, writings on the walls from some of these detainees.
Right. So this is the wall poem that opens the book. And I chose it because it relates very much to the situation of my protagonist, that he had a certain life that he was planning on, and he got yanked out of that life because his father had plans to come to America. As a rule, a person is 20 before he starts making a living. Family circumstances have forced me to experience wind and dust. The heartless months and years seem bent on defeating me. It is a pity that time quickly ages one.
Hmm. Yeah. And this is not Tygo's dream, right? It's his father's dream.
Right.
Brings them here.
Exactly. I made a decision at the beginning of planning the novel that, first of all, that it would be a YA novel with a teenage protagonist, and that the teenage protagonist would not want to come to America, that he would be against the plan of his family. And this was really useful because, well, first of all, because, you know, with a YA novel, you want some sort of teen rebellion, you want some sort of conflict between him and his family. But second, it had the unexpected benefit that because Tygo is rejecting what I call the default story of immigration, that the sort of the standard story of the impoverished immigrant coming to America in order to make a better economic life for himself. Because, and that's his father's, basically his father's dream, that's his father's mission. But because he's rejecting that mission, he suddenly has to, I suddenly had to find some other reason for him to be in America. I had to find some other purpose for him to discover some other reason for being here, some other way for the book to end with some sense of resolution. And I think that allowed the book to become larger than it might have been originally, for the story to become more meaningful, more layered than it otherwise would have.
So Tygo has to first come to terms with his own racism, you say in the introduction here. He does call the white folks ghosts, I guess. Is that part of it? Tell me about that, his own racism.
Yeah, so, right. So, yeah, there's the Chinese in the novel call the Caucasians they encounter white ghosts. And this is actually real Cantonese slang for Caucasians. Tygo actually personally doesn't adopt that term. He decides on a better term. He decides to call the white powers the pale powers. The Chinese population in general in detention call their white jailers white ghosts. There's a black teenage kitchen worker in the story who they basically call a black ghost. And there's a point in the story when my protagonist wonders, wow, do we basically call anybody who's not Chinese some kind of ghost, you know, some kind of demon? The Chinese detainees do in fact exercise prejudice against other groups that they see as lower than them. And it was important to me that I show this in the novel, that they were not perfectly innocent victims of racism, but that they could be racist themselves towards other groups. For example, the black teenage kitchen worker, or a half Chinese, half Japanese girl who's in the women's half of detention. It was important to me that my protagonist overcome his own issues, as well as coming to terms, coming to ways of dealing with the racism that's being exercised against him.
So once these folks get through Angel Island, months, right? Could be year or more.
Right, for some people.
For some people. I imagine there's still barriers, right? Even though they're successful, they sell their paper story, they're able to come. I imagine there's still prejudices, still barriers that they have to overcome.
For sure, yeah. The novel ends with my protagonist's entry into America, but I don't write any further about what he experiences once he's here. But yeah, there would have been many, many difficulties. There would have been many, many helpers. One of the features of the life of detention was that there was a self-governing association that my protagonist initially sees as collaborators with his white jailers, but eventually comes to see are performing a very difficult task, kind of walking the line, trying to protect the fellow detainees from the punishment of the white jailers, while also advocating for them to the white jailers. This association was an historical feature of the detention center in Angel Island, and also has been a historical feature of Chinese life in other countries, is that these associations form that advocate for their own people. So he would have had the help of the associations. He would have had the help of Chinese newspapers. In one scene in the novel, there's a reporter from a Chinese newspaper comes to interview the detainees about a riot that they've just thrown for better conditions. So there would have been Chinese newspapers that would advocate, you know, for their rights as well out in the mainland. But yeah, it would have also been difficult because the prejudices and the xenophobia that existed prior to the Exclusion Act would still have been in place to a large extent.
If you just joined us, we're talking with the writer Freeman Ng. He's author of Bridge Across the Sky. So we're talking about a young adult novel in verse based on the Chinese immigration experience through Angel Island. We'll take another brief break and be back with more following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Freeman Ng. He's author most recently of Bridge Across the Sky. That's a young adult novel in verse based on the Chinese immigration experience through Angel Island in the early 1900s. So Freeman Ng, could you read us another passage from the book?
Sure. This is a passage, again, from early in the novel. My protagonist has participated in an riot for better conditions that actually led to improved conditions. And so at this point in the novel, he's feeling quite optimistic about the future for the Chinese in America. More optimistic than he'll be feeling at the end of the novel exactly, but so he's living in these very triumphant days. And he makes reference to the San Francisco fire and earthquake that destroyed the family records and enabled the Chinese to come in the first place. It's called From Rubble. I lie in my bunk, unable to sleep yet again. I've gotten so little since the day of the action in the dining hall. Awake through that night and far into subsequent nights, from worry at first and then in celebration, unwilling for the waking hours of these triumphant days to end. I imagine San Francisco ablaze with the fire that followed the earthquake, that made our entry possible by destroying the records of businesses and births, by wiping clean the slates on which we're writing our new stories. I imagine the fire burning on from city to city across this land, the world consuming all of the past, the ancient hatreds, fears, a world broken and then burned. I lie in my bunk, unable not to dream of the new world rising from rubble and ash, in the light of bright days to come, and the moonlight faint through the windows.
That is Freeman Ng from his book, Bridge Across the Sky. Interestingly, in the book, you feature the game Go.
Yes.
I encountered this in a novel many years ago. I haven't got it. I should get in and play it. You play, I think, right? Tell me about Go.
Yeah, well, I play Go. I love the game of Go. Go is basically the chess of Asia, the chess of East Asia. It's an equally complex game. I would actually even say more complex, and at the same time, I think more beautiful. I've played Go for quite a while and loved the game. And on my first visit to the Angel Island immigration station, as I was beginning to write this book, what they've done is they've staged many of the rooms to look like they might have looked back in the day. So the sleeping quarters with these rows of triple decker bunk beds, you know, squeezed together, really, really crowded in really crowded conditions. But there was also a game room, and in the game room was they had staged a ping pong table, a mahjong set, a Victrola, and a Go set. And when I first saw the Go set, I was really surprised, and then I realized, wait a minute, there should be no surprise about this because Go is the chess of Asia. It was actually invented in China several thousand years ago. It's the oldest continually played game in the world. And when I saw that there was a Go set in the game room, I thought, well, I've got to put the game of Go in my novel somehow. You know, I've got as kind of a little product placement, as kind of a PR for the game of Go, this game that I love. What I didn't expect was that the game of Go was going to play a crucial role in the story. In the course of the novel, my protagonist plays two games of Go against his grandfather. And then there's a third scene where his grandfather analyzes the second game that they played. And those games ended up occurring at really key moments in my protagonist's story arc. And they ended up reflecting in a really powerful way his mental state at the time of each scene. And his grandfather's analysis of that final game ends up basically teaching him the lesson that he learns in the novel, the conviction he gains that allows him to resolve the major conflict in his story and find his way to the novel's ending. I didn't realize that this would happen when I first put the game in, but it's one of those things that happens when you write, is elements of your story evolve, they take on a life of their own, and sometimes they rise to become a major parts of your story when you didn't expect it.
Just a few minutes left in conversation. I'd like to get on some other things. Anything else you'd like to say about Bridge Across the Sky?
Well, I'd like to say a word about the Black teenage kitchen worker, who was another element that I introduced into the book just to achieve a kind of a side purpose, is that I wanted to portray the fact that the Chinese were not the only group at the time in America that were being oppressed. So I put in this Black teenage kitchen worker just in order to have that little historical side fact in the novel. And he, like the game of Go, grew to the point that he ended up on the cover. His story ended up being entwined with my protagonist's in a way that it became the major main A plot of the novel. And that was also unexpected. One of the ways that writing takes on a life of its own.
The book is Bridge Across the Sky, as said, available now. It's about the Chinese immigration experience through Angel Island, pointed to the young adult, category, but able to be read and enjoyed by any audience. It's a novel in verse as well. I want to talk about, speaking of verse, I want to talk about haiku. It's a famous form, right? You've done a haiku a day for periods. First of all, tell us what the forum is.
Well, a haiku is basically a short poem of three lines. That's the most basic definition. There are classically have been additional rules, such as syllable count, the need for a season word, a word that sort of relates to some season of the year, a kind of a turning point, a kind of a flipping point in the poem. But following these additional rules is sort of optional for English language haiku. Particularly the syllable count. Many English speakers like to write 5-7-5 haiku, but actually English syllables are much weightier than Japanese syllables. So when you write English haiku in 5-7-5, it comes out sounding much more wordy than classical Japanese haiku. So most serious haiku written these days doesn't follow any syllable count. But basically, yeah, it's just three short lines that paints a very simple, poignant scene.
And you know, it's become quite popular, I think, maybe the simplicity. For example, historian H.W. Brands, for a while, was writing a history of America, one haiku a day on Twitter. I don't know if he's still doing that.
That's awesome.
You wrote a book, Basho's Haiku Journeys. Tell me briefly about that.
Well, it's a picture book about the life of the Japanese haiku poet, Matsuo Basho, who was actually practically the inventor of haiku. He was, for certain, the one who turned haiku into a serious poetic form. And he's most well known for five journeys that he took, five travel journals that he basically wrote based on these journeys that mix prose with haiku. And so I wrote a picture book about those journeys that he took. And of course, I had to write it in haiku, given that it was about Basho.
Right. Just very briefly, just have a couple minutes left. This book struck me, Who Am I? It's a picture book, which is the story of a child who wakes up one morning not remembering who he or she is. What struck me here is you can answer 20 different questions and it'll be kind of personalized for, I guess, for your child. What did you want to write this? What led you to this?
It was the diverse books movement actually that inspired me to write this book. The movement that is trying to encourage more children's books that portray people of all different races and ethnicities. And so I thought, well, what about a single picture book that could sort of come in different versions depending on how you wanted the child in the story to look, what color skin you wanted them to have, what gender you wanted them to be. So basically the book comes in 20 different flavors, and you pick a gender and a skin color, and then you can buy that version of the book. And of course the story of the book is about a child forgetting who they are and then coming back to a remembrance of their identity. So that kind of fits the theme as well.
We'll reach the end of our time. Much else you could. So check out Freeman Ng at, I think it's Author Freeman Ng. Author Freeman.
Yeah, authorfreeman.com.
Yeah, authorfreeman.com. And you've done a bunch of stuff. We could go another hour probably. You've written some music, a book on Joan of Arc, that comic strip, right? Trumpert. And much else. So you can check out authorfreeman.com for that. And check out the book, of course, the latest book, Bridge Across the Sky. Freeman Ng, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Skywatcher Leo T, where it's one sky, many cultures, as thankfully temperatures have cooled and the breeze kicked in with a little bit of rain here and there. And when the planet turns to sunset and dusk, then purple, then night, as we continue to keep an eye on Saturn, which continues to rise higher in the southeast, and by dawn we'll have rotated to the west to join Jupiter and Venus as the morning stars as the east and the dawn breaks. Oh, and just so you know, the moon reached perigee, its closest point to us, in its elliptical orbit around Earth on September 10th, It's just around 226,000 miles away now, and you can spot the mares or seas on the moon very well right now, or the rabbit, or the man in the moon, or for me, the Motown label singer. I mean, look at it, really. It looks like the Motown label singer. And let's go deep. Go out. Keep going. After dark, look due east for the appearance of the great square of Pegasus. Its appearance to the east signals the changing of the seasons and the coming of the southward equinox, now less than 2 weeks away. And let's check in on NASA's Mars Perseverance rover, which acquired an image of a great area out there on August 31st using its onboard left navigation camera, my favorite one. The camera's located high on the rover's mast and aids in driving. See the image on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page, courtesy of NASA, JPL, and Caltech. Just a few days ago, the rover transitioned into an exciting part of the journey, driving northwest of the Sonora Ridge and entering an area filled with diverse range of boulders that the science team believes could hold more clues to Mars's earlier history. JPL reports that the terrain they are exploring is known as the Megabrechia, a chaotic mixture of broken rock fragments likely produced during ancient asteroid impact in Jezero's geology, and they're looking around up there. As Comet 31 Atlas continues to blaze through the solar system, the European Space Agency believes it may be able to send one of its outer planet probes to have a closer look when the interstellar loper comes near Mars. See if we can look inside and see who the aliens are. It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Let's check in on the coyote and the wolves. Out on the plains where they meet the creeks and the hills and the mountains and the rivers, an old Pawnee story narrated during the first thunder ceremony tells of fools, the wolves, the coyote deity, and Prahuksti, grandfather of lightning, controller of all fires, and lighter of the stars that enabled people to go out at night. Prahuksti had its own star, the evening star, that rivaled Fools, the wolves' morning star. Fools, the wolves, became jealous of the evening star's luminescence and power. They say that originally Prahuksti placed all the constellations on the ground forever as an immortal race, but Fool the Wolves sent a pack of wolves to steal Prahuksti's lightning bag, and the story spirals into another unhappy facet, but ends with the coyote star enlisting the help of the snake star, or Antares, who sent snakes to delicately persuade those who tell bad stories about him. Aho! Keep looking up, look around, tell some stories. Skywatcher Leo T.